You're listening to An Introduction to the Catholic Life.
Buonasera.
And welcome to episode 19 of An Introduction to the Catholic Life. We're actually here in a completely different setting, so if we sound a little bit echoey, that's why. But we have the full team around the table today. We've got a nice circular table. We're all looking in at each other, which is quite soothing. So we have James, Sean, and Rory, and myself here today. So how have you been, guys?
Good. I think this is a good layout, actually. I think it's very inclusive.
I feel
we're all equal.
I can look at all your faces equally, in equal proportion.
It's very ideal, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is great. I feel welcomed. I feel safe. I feel soothed.
So because of other commitments, we've decided to meet this one time at the Glasgow University Catholic Chaplaincy. So we're upstairs in the hall, which is a change of scenery, but, you know, just shows our dedication.
It's a neutral venue for a change.
Yep. Although we are quite close to part of Thistle Stadium, to be fair. So
you're not too far away. What I don't like about this layout, there's no corners for me to hide in, literally. It's a round setup.
We've actually got beer this week. I think we've been phonies for the past few recordings. I think we've like been drinking coffee and...
Yeah, I got a complaint actually about that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. From Michael Cairns.
Michael Cairns, seminarian.
He said, I don't know, he just said something about fake news because we said the pint and the mic and the cross and then we weren't drinking every time we were recording.
You can't really drink beer at 9 o'clock in the morning, but I mean, we could try.
We could try, but we won't.
No.
Well, no fake news this week. We are drinking beer. That's probably a pint-sized glass, so
yep.
Sticking to our motto.
It's a nice warm day outside and we've got the window open. We're sitting at the window with a cool beer. It's quite relaxed.
No, this is the way life should be.
You two, James and Sean, are off to Spain next week, am I right?
This Friday. So, a big holiday, looking forward to it. I've not been on holiday. I've not taken many holidays from work this entire year, so I've got like all of them at one time, which is brilliant.
It's probably absolutely freezing in Spain, though. Snowstorms over there.
I don't know. I need a break from the hot weather as well here.
So. It's too warm. That's it. This heat wave's been going on for a while now. How many weeks? Three or four weeks.
Yeah, like at least three.
And it's set to continue, I think.
That's the thing. I think overall, I think the statistics on mental health in Scotland would go up if we were guaranteed a month of sunny weather every year.
True.
Yeah. I agree.
How's your mental health?
Still mental.
Today we're going to be talking about something which has been coming up quite a lot in Catholic media news channels recently, and that's Humani Vitae. We're approaching the 50th anniversary of its promulgation, and those of you in the UK especially will realise that over the past couple of weeks there was 500 priests from the UK signed a letter to basically say that they affirm the teaching of this document and its importance in the Catholic life. And last week as well, about 180 young Catholics also signed a similar document to say the same. And so it's something which is kind of circling around in Catholic media right now. We thought it would be something which we could be good to sink our teeth into. So the Humani Vitae was a papal encyclical promulgated by Blessed Pope Paul VI in response to several pastoral issues that were basically emerging within society that he felt the church had to respond to, namely the rising popularity of the pill and things like the sexual revolution that were going on at the same time in the 60s. I got a little nice summary by Bishop Robert Barron, which I thought summarised the main thrust of the argument. He says, "The integrity of the sexual act is a function of the coming together of its unitive and procreative dimensions. So when the sexual act expresses love between the husband and wife and remains open to the conception of a child, it has this integral quality. When, through a conscious choice, the married couple introduces an artificial block to this marital act, we are doing something that violates this integrity and goes against God's will for them. Pope Paul VI decided to write on this because he understood and he said that the transmission of human life was a serious role within marriage, and it affected the church widely. And so it was important to make sure that he applied the traditional Catholic teaching on the morality or around marriage and apply it to basically contemporary issues. So we've all just reread the document. Do you guys think that it could be seen in some ways controversial? Because of course it is today even still seen as quite controversial.
I think many people still have the problem, and maybe it will be a problem that's always around, where the church weighs in on a kind of contentious moral issue. I think people sometimes find an issue with the church saying what you can and cannot do. But near the start of this document, which I was reading this morning, Pope Paul VI affirms that, you know, the promulgation of the moral law, the natural law, is in the competency of the magisterium of the church. And so I think that's where maybe people start to find an issue with this problem, saying, you know, no contraception is not okay. But on closer inspection of the argument as Pope Paul VI laid it out, I mean, it makes perfect sense, and indeed the church should be weighing in on issues like these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's also a big issue for a lot of people because it touches on so many people's lives. So if you think about it, marriage is probably the biggest vocation that people are called to in the church and without it as well. So there's going to be a lot of people who are, you know, married or not, who find a problem with this, whether they're in the church or not.
It's perhaps appropriate that a couple of weeks ago we spoke about the importance and centrality of the papacy in proposing the faith, certainly, but also diagnosing culture and society. We don't find more clear examples of that than Pope Paul VI, Blessed Pope Paul VI, and his publication of the document Humani Vitae. It's in so many ways a prophetic document, and it's a prophetic expression of the Petrine office, in fact. No matter what chaotic going on there may have been in the 1960s in and outside the church, Pope Paul VI diagnoses the state of society incredibly accurately, and the fruits, or rather the bitter fruits of that period, can still be tasted today. We have a situation where we have a majority almost in the Western world who come from broken families or who have difficulties within their families. Those pillars which used to be so standard, so normal, so central to so many people have simply collapsed. And what Pope Paul VI is doing here is he's diagnosing why that might be, and he's proposing a solution to it, which is to come full circle, an eminently prophetic part of the Petrine ministry.
Yeah, I think it's a really good example of the, like you said, really the kind of pastoral role of the Pope, of the papacy. And so he identifies in the document four key issues which he sees as needing addressed, basically needing the church's moral teaching to be applied to them. And so the first one is he talks about the rapid increase in population, which has made many fear that the population of the world is going to grow faster than the available resources that are there for us. The second one is that there is also the fact that not only working and housing conditions, but the greater demands made on the economic and educational field pose a living situation in which, you know, people can say, well, you can't really have a large family in these economic circumstances. The third one is that he says that, you know, well, there's a new understanding of the dignity of women and within society, and that's leading people to start to think about love and marriage and relationships in a different way. And finally, he points to the fact that man is moving towards this, endeavouring towards basically extending his control over everything in his life, so over his body, his mind, his emotions, and these sorts of things. So by identifying these four strands within society, which were gaining some momentum, he decided to write a document in response to that, which I think is, you know, we're all grateful for that.
So Connor, you mentioned earlier about the two visions of marriage, which actually I found really, I mean, it's something that it's good to kind of put words to, quite just to kind of articulate a thought, which probably many practicing Catholics will have seen played out in their daily lives. But, you know, that is the secular view of marriage and the Catholic view of marriage, which are so radically different, and one very much more kind of hopeful than the other, which I think would be good to chat about.
Yeah, and it's really important to understand those two visions of marriage, I think, in order to then understand Humani Vitae. If you read Humani Vitae from a secular point of view, you I don't think you understand it without understanding the rich theology behind Catholic marriage. So if you come from a purely materialistic point of view, where marriage is purely a contractual thing, for as long as a particular love between persons may last. Then, of course, Humani Vitae and its talk about self-sacrificial love and a love that is lasting and these sorts of things is going to be perhaps be something which you know it's hard to understand. Whereas, of course, as Catholics, we believe that marriage is a sacrament raised to this dignity of a sacrament by the Lord, and it's for the sanctity of the husband and wife and for the procreation of children.
The Catholic teaching around marriage is in some ways a proposal of what human nature can or could be, which runs absolutely counter to what society or popular culture might well say human beings actually are. I often think that despite the fact that it seems that the Church maybe proposes a number of propositions which are particularly challenging, in so doing she also recognises that human beings are by nature heroic beings. We are capable of so much more than we think we are capable of. And so when the Church lays down the gauntlet, as it were, be it with this particular difficult teaching, for want of a better phrase, she's in fact acknowledging the innate heroism within human beings, be it individuals or two individuals who are within a sacramental marriage. It's in fact a proposal of the heroism of which human beings are capable. Society, unfortunately, certainly secular society, seems to have a very low view of human nature. You spoke a little bit earlier on about worries about population and its exponential growth and so forth. But you never ever hear any discussion about the innate capacity of human beings for creativity and ingenuity. No matter what circumstances we have faced or come up against before, we have always managed to come up with solutions or proposals to navigate particular paths or obstacles. I think that's something which the Church proposes time after time, right through the ages. No matter what societal or cultural difficulties we face, human beings can overcome that through their heroic and ingenious nature. That's something which the Church maybe gets right and proposes strongly, in strong terms today certainly, which society doesn't really seem to do.
Mm. Yeah, human nature does often surprise society. And I was reading something not too long ago which I found kind of quite funny, but it kind of demonstrates that ingenuity we have as humans to overcome problems. Whether now this one isn't maybe so much a moral problem, but back in the day, when London was full of kind of horse-drawn carriages and all the rest of it, the intellectuals, the scientists of the time were saying, oh, you know, but by the year 1900, London will be so full of horse manure that human life will no longer be able to flourish here. You know, it'll be barren, it'll be uninhabitable, all the rest of it. 4 years later, from when all these doomsday kind of scientists were out, the engine was invented. You know, so problems that we see, oh, you know, there's no foreseeable cure for this. We can't, there are ways around these things. And, you know, that's a trivial example. But, these examples that Pope Paul VI did lay out, you know, we have it within us, whether it be by ingenuity or heroism to overcome these things.
I think that's absolutely right. The Church almost foresees human ingenuity before it appears in individual lives or in, you know, across nations or what have you. Similarly, Blessed Paul VI foresees some of the difficulties which are to come or were to come at the time, and which we have seen since in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. We spoke a little bit earlier on about broken families and so forth, but even in the last couple of years, there's been an awful lot written and studied about the really harmful effects of the pill itself. You know, when it was released onto the mass market, first of all, in the 1960s, it was seen to be a tool of liberation. If anything, it's a tool of enslavement. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's harmful to the individual's physical health, certainly. Moreover, it's harmful to their mental well-being. When we come to view those around us as a means to an end, i.e. a pleasurable end, that's innately problematic for others and fundamentally for ourselves at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those two points, one is the question, I think, that Pope Paul brings up at the start, and he's saying, given the present conditions of life and the significance that acts of marital intercourse have for spouses' harmony and mutual fidelity, wouldn't it be appropriate to rethink the present moral norms, especially if it is felt that they cannot be adhered to without sacrifices, sometimes requiring heroic effort, which we just spoke about to begin. And with that, he then goes on to talk about what marriage is. Mm. You know, and at one point he says, above all, this love is fully human. That is something both of the senses and spiritual. So it's not just this contract. So it's a matter not of natural or affective instinct alone, but also and above all an act of free will, whose intention is that the love not only survives the joys and sorrows of daily life, but also grow, so that the spouses become in a way one heart and one soul, and can in this unity reach their human perfection together. So there's small, simple statements in this document that you can really, if you really think about, they give us a wider view of the questions that are coming up, which we are now hearing all the time, and also the answers to that.
Yeah.
I think it's coming up, if we look at, if you followed anything the Youth Synod, we're having these questions again on different aspects of human life, and that there is, you know, we need to rethink moral norms because we can't live them out. Where in fact, although it would be heroic to have to live out a life where you give up things to live together and to grow together, not just through joys and sorrows, but to become one heart and one soul. I think, you know, I think it speaks beautifully of what marriage really is.
Mm. Yeah, and I think something which is quite striking, which is basically what you've just said there, with, in terms of the fact that in the document, a lot of the criticisms that he gives us and says, you know, some people will say this, we've already spoken about these kind of socio-economic difficulties, rise in population, these sorts of things. These are all stuff that we still hear today. People still use those kind of arguments against the Catholic vision for marriage. And they basically say that, you know, living the Catholic life is not responsible. In that sense, it's not a responsible parenthood, which is interesting because obviously in the document, he himself coins that phrase, responsible parenthood, and he gives it a Catholic flavour. I'll just read what he says in this. He says, "The exercise of responsible parenthood requires that husband and wife, keeping a right and proper order of priorities, recognise their own duties towards God, themselves, their families, and human society. From this, it follows that they are not free to act as they choose in the service of transmitting life, as if it were wholly up to them to decide what is right, what is the right course to follow. On the contrary, they are bound to ensure that what they do corresponds to the will of God, the Creator." So he's basically pointing to this, which is what we see quite often in the podcast, that in life, in the Catholic life, you have to get your priorities straight. You know, are you here to please yourself or are you here to please God? And there is a hierarchy there. And he's saying, you know, you have to look at the natural law and God's law and revelation and live your life towards that rather than just simply seeking your own pleasure and your own satisfaction.
I think for a lot of people, the problem with that as well is that they've never had a good example of it.
Mm.
You know, in reading this document, there's things where I think, you know, not to say my mum and dad are perfect or anything, but they've given me a good example of what a long and fruitful married life should be. They got married when they were 19 and 20. They've had 8 children, which is totally countercultural. Couldn't afford to have children like that. But they've grown so much that, they are one person almost, you know what I mean? And they gave up things, you know, they sacrificed, you know, a social life, these different things to be responsible parents,
sleep,
brothers and sisters.
Sleep, I'm sure.
It's these examples which many are missing, sadly, not necessarily through any fault of their own either. And an important phrase is that one which Paul VI himself coined, responsible parenthood, in that it's one which secular society often gets absolutely upside down and disastrously wrong. Responsible parenthood is often used as a synonym almost for the absence of parenthood. So, i.e., if you recuse yourself from parental responsibility, from the Marriage Act effectively, then that is the responsible thing to do. The Marriage Act in its fullness, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
That is the responsible thing to do. Okay, be that as it may, fast forward 50 years, you have countries across Western Europe which are really, really struggling. You know, we don't currently follow along secular lines a model which is sustainable. If we want to talk about socio-economic difficulties, well, look at Germany, look at Russia, look at Italy. We don't even have enough young people, using the term broadly, to care for the elderly, to care for the poor. If this is responsibility, then I don't have anything to do with it, I must say.
Another aspect of that that I've been thinking about recently, or that's came up, is Pope Paul talks about the natural law, which is written into nature, which is written in the things that we can see around us. Which, you know, he says the magisterium has the right to interpret. But we've missed out on that by living our lives until we're whatever age and then getting married once we feel ready, once we're responsible, once we have enough money and stuff like that. We should be doing it younger, I think. You know, we can, for example, you, Naomi, got married at 25 and 23. And it's a good example to us and a good example.
24 and 22.
And you've got a child now. And do you know what I mean? People would say that you're not responsible because you've not got enough money to.
I don't have any money.
But this is when you should be doing it, and this is, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, and you're happy in that.
I think it gets back to your point about example, because I mean, whenever Naomi and I first started dating, we were introduced to a fantastic example of Catholic marriage and through the chaplaincy. You all know the family I'm talking about, who are in their 30s and they have 6 kids, and they're completely devoted to living the Catholic life and the vision of marriage and to its fullness. And when we first encountered that, along with various other young Catholics, we were completely astounded at how beautiful a life it is, but also, of course, how countercultural it is as well, and how, you know, this is not what people would see as responsible parenthood in that sense, you know. But it is the Catholic parenthood, and it's Catholic to its fullest, and it's really, there's a real beauty that comes out of that. And then that means that whenever me and Naomi started this own marriage together, that was really, when we thought about Catholic marriage, that was the vision we had this perfect example of Catholic marriage, and that's obviously something that we're really blessed to have, because a lot of people don't have that, but nonetheless, I think it's still important to look at this document and to think about, if you were to live this out in your life, what would your life look like and how would it be different?
I think one theme that comes up in the document several times, and has come up in just the last 5 minutes several times, is that, you know, self-sacrificial element, and that's something that is deeply rooted in the Catholic life, and it's something that the world, much like many other things, gets pretty wrong. I think the kind of creed of the world, the kind of dogma, would be, you know, the more things you can get for yourself, the more you can take, the happier you will be. Whereas what the Catholic life, what the moral teaching of the Church has always affirmed, is that actually, counterintuitively to what we might think be best, the more you give of yourself, the more you give of yourself to other people and to God, the more fulfilled you are. And the world really does get wrong where we will find our fulfillment, and this document presents that kind of view of marriage that will bring true and lasting fulfillment, that will, you know, itself bear the fruit of many fruitful marriages, Catholic marriages, which are so much more filled with hope and genuine sacrificial love than what the world would propose. Mm-hmm.
Joy doesn't come without responsibility. You know, responsibility, particularly parental or familial responsibility, begets joy in a manner which we simply do not get if we remove ourselves from a Catholic context. We often wrongly like to think, as individuals in the postmodern world, that joy is somehow something which we can almost construct ourselves. You know, if we hoard sums of money or become particularly proud about one or other achievements in our lives, we somehow labour under this misapprehension that we will eventually reach this point where we will almost mystically become happy. But it's not true. It's not true. It's never been true. And there's often a danger of making the modern world a particular point of reference. That's always what you hear, isn't it? Yes, but in the modern world this happens. In the modern world that happens. Every single modern world which has ever existed has eventually become the past. That's true with this generation as well. Eventually what we term to be new or modern, or something which is appropriate to our times, will become old-fashioned very, very quickly. And so we do ourselves and others a great disservice by putting too much of an emphasis on the source of happiness, on modern times and its habits.
So obviously, from reading Humani Vitae, it's quite clear that as Catholics, we are against the use of contraception within marriage. And so a lot of Catholics then move towards something called natural family planning in order to space births within the household. And so there is a kind of common misconception, and I'm sure you guys have heard it before as well, even among good Catholics, who say, you know, what is the difference really between NFP and, you know, using contraception? Isn't it just Catholic contraception?
Oh no, and to begin with, I had that thought as well. I think it's a good question to have, because, you know, for someone actually thinking about it, you know, there is some similarities in a sense. But there's a Catholic answer to that, which I've heard as well, which is good.
from the kind of starting point is they're both avoiding pregnancy, I guess. Yeah. So that's why they're quite similar. Because in both instances, you're a couple contracepting and then a couple using NFP. Then yeah, they're both coming from the standpoint of perhaps that we want to, you know, avoid having children at this time. And politics does say that in serious circumstances, that can be allowed, but not using artificial contraception. And so with NFP, you're basically using the natural order of the woman's cycle and the things that are in the natural law as a way into space births in your family. And so there's this idea then within Catholic marriage of chastity in some way, and that there are some points in your married life in which if you do not want to have children, you simply just do not have sex. And that, of course, within society can be something as, you know, which is quite shocking. You're like, why would you not just have sex? Like, this is because you can just contracept and this is, you know. But there is a difference there because, of course, if you're just not having sex, then that's different than putting something artificial in the way.
The thing that I heard from that was, or from an answer, was actually Bishop John Keenan was talking about it. He was talking about the theology of the body on this topic. And he was talking about how NFP allows you to love in a very Catholic way. So the natural cycle of the woman gives a time for a procreative period, a chaste period, and a unitative period, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And that by following the natural law, you then, you know, you're not just succumbed to your desires, but you're also respecting and loving your partner, mm-hmm. In a way that is both, you know, unitative for your marriage, but you know, has respect.
And I think an important part, probably the most important part to mention about NFP, is it's open to life. I think the distinction in why we would, you know, a prophylactic is contraception and NFP, natural family planning, is that. A prophylactic, any kind of artificial means, puts a physical barrier between the spouses. NFP does not. It uses natural means to space births. And also, bearing in mind that, you know, obviously the Catholic guidelines, if you like, you know, in the catechism and whatnot for NFP, is that it must be discerned as well with God. So it's not just us choosing to have, you know, and you said that earlier on, Connor, as well. The whole element of the procreation of human life is something that we cooperate with God in, and that kind of means of spacing births, natural family planning, allows us to space the births and also to discern what God is calling of a married couple. Is he calling them to have to be generous and to have a child, or is he calling them to a time of chastity or what have you? But it's this kind of discerning, element of NFP as well, which makes it thoroughly.
Because if you, and it does state that if you're just using NFP to avoid pregnancy on no proper grounds without discernment, then it's a sin as well.
Yeah. Because that is Catholic contraception.
Exactly.
To put it in inverted commas, that's not. Mm. But.
Okay, so another big thing which people talk about with regards to Humanae Vitae is that Blessed Paul VI is a prophet. There's several parts of Humanae Vitae, but namely section 17 of the document, which in which he says some, you know, amazing statements. And when you read it and you realise that it was written in, you know, 68, and you think about today's society, then you get this big feeling of like, wow, he was a prophet. He saw what was coming quite clearly. He had an understanding of society and what these mainstream ideas would lead to, basically, if they were accepted and promoted within society. So one example is this: let them first consider how easily this course of action could open wide the way for marital infidelity and a general lowering of moral standards. Not much experience is needed to be fully aware of human weakness, and to understand that human beings, and especially the young, who are so exposed to temptation, need incentives to keep the moral law, and it is an evil thing to make it easy for them to break that law. And so I think anyone in today's society, especially if you're Catholic, is very hard to deny that that's true. You think of the weakening of the institution of marriage you've seen widespread in society, think of the rising number of, you know, infidelities in marriage, you know, people cheating on each other and these sorts of things, and just the general lowering of moral standards.
See, when I read that, the first example that came into my head was, if you've been following the World Cup, was, you know, there's this talk about how the England team are a much more likeable team, and they've got rid of the guys like John Terry, who, you know, was sleeping with his teammates' wives and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, these guys who people would just genuinely despise, and they've got a good group of young, moral guys like Harry Kane, who's married with a family with, like, you know,
second child on the way,
but like a childhood sweetheart, this kind, you know, this kind of image, and then at the end, well, you know, and I have seen comments, people on Facebook saying, if he hasn't cheated on his wife, you know, but there's always that kind of sentence where the immediate thought of people now is that people aren't living, you know, fidelity out.
Yeah.
And
it's really because people have become numbed to failed marriages or accustomed to them, overly accustomed to them, really. So it's no secret that most people of our generation don't get married at all, or if they do, it'll be much later on in life. If you ask them, why do you not want to get married to your partner with whom you've been for 10, 12 years, they'll simply say, for instance, my parents were happily married, didn't work out. I thought they were happily married, but they weren't happily married. And so they divorced and all this kind of stuff. And so eventually you add 2 + 2, you get 4, and unfortunately, far too many people of our age simply say, I do not believe in marriage because it failed for the last generation. Mm. What happened during the last generation or two generations ago? We had the 1960s, we had the sexual revolution, we had the pill becoming normalised and so forth. This is something which Pope Paul VI foresaw in 1968, which so many others simply did not see. And we can absolutely see the results of what happened in the 1960s now. We can see the results of it in general conversations we have with other people of our own age. That's why they're not getting married. That's why they're desperately unhappy, they're suspicious, they're sceptical about the traditional form of marriage and so forth. We needn't wonder, but one strong argument again for the prophetic nature of the Church and of the papacy, indeed, is that Pope Paul VI intuited all of these developments in 1968, long before they actually became apparent.
Yeah. And I think we spoke, actually, in podcast number 2, when Pope Benedict was at Bellhouston Park, he gave that address to young people. I'm sure it might have been yourself, Rory, commented, you know, Pope Benedict displayed an understanding for contemporary culture, much more so than any of us did, much more than any of us do. And the papacy has often, if not always, been like that, where they are able to look at a road that society is going down and saying, look, guys, that's not going to lead you. That's not going to lead you to fulfilment. That's going to lead to a lot of brokenness. And could he have been more right? You know, all we need is to look around or to ask our friends, you know, about their families. It's everywhere. The ripple effect of the sexual revolution and the introduction of contraception on an industrial scale is really quite rife in our society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're part of this consumeristic culture, so even people are now viewed as a means to an end or a sexual...
You're a product, effectively.
Yeah. Yep. And that's exactly... So he says the same thing. So he says, another effect that gives cause for alarm is that a man who grows accustomed to the use of contraceptive methods may forget the reverence due to a woman and, disregarding her physical and emotional equilibrium, reduce her to being a mere instrument for the satisfaction of his own desires, no longer considering her as his partner, whom he should surround with care and affection. And so really, it's getting to that point, isn't it? The key thing is that when sex is reduced to something which is recreational, something which is, you know, easy, then it makes it open to abuse. And this is what we've seen in culture again. No one can deny it. You think there's a million examples within, all you have to do is open up a newspaper to see how this has become such a big thing. And I think, although it's maybe not, you know, you can't rest all of the blame simply at contraception, I think it's still an important part in this, you know, the track that society are going down.
I mean, it was the root of it, really.
Yeah. Wasn't it? But the use of contraception then says that sex is, you know, it's not for a procreative, it's not a procreative use, it's for my own personal satisfaction, which is what our hookup culture tends towards, you know, and that's the way people view each other, and when, you know, they go out, they're only looking out for one thing.
And that kind of idea that he's speaking about, the neglect of the honour that we should show women, is clearly perceived in the kind of the amount of pornography as well.
Yep, is that right?
These days.
I mean, in the culture that we're now seeing with Weinstein and all of these things that have came up in the past, 50 years or whatever, where people have abused their positions because they feel that they have a right to whatever they want. And, you know, and this attitude breeds into every other area of our society as well. And once we have that really self-centred, selfish view, you know, who cares? Who cares exactly. about anyone else?
Uh-huh. And we get all sorts of problems. I mean, there's many people within the church, of course, as well, but I've used the expression the contraceptive mentality as well, which is that kind of attitude towards sex and relationships which completely disregards the essential purpose of them, that, you know, that procreative element. And once you get that contraceptive mentality, once the whole idea of, oh, you know, sex is God's plan for love and procreation between spouses, once that's out the window, yeah, of course we get people like Harvey Weinstein, of course we get pornography on a scale that's never been seen before. Of course we get abuse cases that are, you know, numbers of the like have never been seen. You know, it's taken us down a path that Pope Paul VI again could see 40 years, 50 years before it happened.
It's like a sort of sexual bulimia, really, in that you take something which is part of the natural order, it has its natural process, its natural end, and then you totally subvert it and abuse it effectively. Mm-hmm. That's why it's a strong phrase, but I would term it that. It's like a sexual bulimia. You take a process which is natural, then you completely misuse it. It's the misuse of something which we are given, and the fruits of it can be seen widely.
So if you haven't read Humani Vitae before, then I would recommend you do it. It's about 20 pages, we said. Yeah.
25 pages.
I mean, we all read it within, you can read it within an hour easily.
I read it on my lunch break today.
Yeah.
And it's really prophetic. It's really,
yeah. And really one of the, you know, above and beyond the whole debate around contraception, you know, he really points towards the true dignity and nobility of marriage. A Catholic marriage comes from God, it has its origin with God, and God is, of course, love. I'd like to finish with this quote, actually, by Blessed Paul VI. He says, "It is, in reality, the wise and provident institution of God the Creator, whose purpose was to effect in man his loving design. As a consequence, husband and wife, through that mutual gift of themselves, which is specific and exclusive to them alone, develop that union of two persons in which they perfect one another, cooperating with God in the generation and rearing of new lives."
Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen. I'm absolutely roasting.
It's quite a warm day.
I like walked here really quickly because I was late, and I know these guys are quite strict on time, so I had to pick up some beer as well, so I was walking really quickly. I also had a jacket on, which is stupid in this weather, I know, but I did. And I got in, and we're setting up the podcast, and I was like, I'm literally dying here. So.
Talking about time, it was Lucy Maria's, Connor's daughter's christening on Saturday.
It was.
Were you on time?
No. I was in time. I was here 3 hours before. Naomi and Lucy Maria got there about half an hour before, but basically what happened was half of my family were held up behind the Orange Walk in Paisley.
Oh, was it? Yeah. Oh, right. I didn't
realise
that.
The Orange Walk in Glasgow. I was going to tell you that. So, yeah, half of my family are from Paisley. I'm from Paisley originally. And they were coming through from there, and they get stuck behind the Orange Walk in Paisley and then got to Glasgow and get stuck behind the Orange Walk there. So ended up starting, I think, 20 minutes later or so.
But I just thought this is the way of the Goldies sacraments are going. Is your marriage.
Although I couldn't help notice, though, how late was the wedding starting? Was that 40 minutes? 40
it was ridiculous. So it was like 45.
So that was 40 minutes. That was 2023, I think. I counted. I'm joking. Again. But so you're getting 20 minutes. I don't know if it's a reduction by 20 minutes or halving.
We'll see.
Hopefully by 20 minutes, but we'll see. Yeah, but I think that was rather out of my hands. I mean, I could have started it without my mum, my two grands, my brother, my sister. But
he's a grown, in perfection, obviously, since he's got married.
Right. And it was also, for all of us, I think, the first extraordinary form baptism we've been to.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Nice.
So the lovely prayers in that. The one at the start, that was my favourite.
The churching of the woman?
No.
No.
The question to the godparents.
Oh, yeah. Feed him.
Yeah.
Feed him.
What do you ask of the church?
Faith.
And what does the faith of the church give you?
Eternal life.
Yes.
Or life everlasting, one of the two. Yeah, no, it's beautiful. No, I mean, it's the richness of the prayers was, you know, I think everyone I mean, I didn't hear a bad thing about it. I mean, there was lots, quite a few people there, and everyone was saying how beautiful it was. So it's very nice.
Which all
baptized. I made a nice barbecue, which was really cooked by James, and yeah, it was nice.
You're all welcome. Aye. By cooked, we mean burnt. I think I was serving people wee black rocks instead of burgers.
It was good.
It was good. The godmother did well.
She did well, yeah.
She did. Mm-hmm. She's asked us for a shout out for about 5 times. She only listens to the end of the podcast now. She doesn't actually listen to the podcast. She just listens to the end to see if she gets a shout out.
Oh, okay. So we should have given her a shout out.
We should have given her one in the middle.
No.
Oh, man. Wait, can we just insert it in the middle?
We could. Cut it out. Okay. Cut it on, yeah.
This is like the bit in the textbook where you, like, you know, turn to page 5. Okay, go to 16 minutes and you'll hear your shout out.
You'll just hear in the background someone going, Katie Tennant. Well, shout out to Katie Tennant. You're fantastic. And you did very well. Yeah.
Yes, well done.
Listen, Maria.
Oh, because in the extraordinary form, the godmother holds the baby.
Mm-hmm, the whole time.
And the baby was crying.
Yep. So she was okay for most of it, but then as soon as the water touched her head, she started going mental.
It was good though.
And she calmed down with the blessed salt was quite interesting. I thought she wouldn't like that, but you know, she liked it.
That's good.
So it's not too bad.
Salt. I've got some blessed salt in my room. I'll take it on holiday. We can exercise people.
So we've.
Or you could put it in your chips.
We've now blessed chips. Mm.
Yum.
I should be burnt at the stake. For
but we've now got a holiday for 10 days, and then Rory goes on holiday.
Mm-hmm. He's away to preach in America.
Yep. He's got his wee sign.
Have you been saved? Have I been saved? Who knows?
Have you got a wee sign saying evolution is a hoax?
I saw one of those in Glasgow today. So did I.
Yeah. Wow. I saw two of them. There was two of them walking together down at St. Luke's.
Yeah, basically we have a couple of weeks now where we're not all going to be together. Or it's going to be very, very hard to get that to happen. So it's either going to be just a couple of us recording, or we'll take a wee break, unfortunately.
It'll be a skeleton service.
Yeah. Oh, I hate
no
this.
Hymns.
No hymns.
ScotRail skeleton service.
Oh, yeah. That is terrible. Yeah.
So, thanks very much for listening, guys. As usual, you can find us on Facebook and on Instagram, Twitter, and on our website and on iTunes. So until the next time, cheers to the pint, the mic, and the cross.
Cheers. Cheers. Cheers.